Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kopernik Global Investors Third Quarter 2019 Conference. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I'd like to turn things over to Mr. Kasim Ghaffar. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Rachel. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the Third Quarter 2019 Conference Call. My name is Kasim Ghaffar, and I have with me David Ivan, our CIO and Lead Portfolio Manager for the Kopernik Global All-Cap Strategy and Co-PM for the International Strategy. Before I pass the call over today for the bulk of the call, I'd like to give everyone a quick firm update. From an overall AUM standpoint, the firm assets at the end of the quarter were right around $4 billion, versus $3.4 billion at the end of 2018. This represents roughly net new net flows of around $300 million just in this year, which is around net new growth of 10%. Clearly, this growth came during a period which has been one of the longest momentum-driven markets, which has not been conducive to our style of investing given our strong value bent. We are very grateful for the trust ensured by all of our clients, and we strongly believe our clients will be rewarded over the long term as and when the cycle finally turns. Lastly, on the firm, I would like to add that we are 38 people strong and have been stable over the years. Please note, Dave will be referring to a presentation which can be found on the website at www.kopernikglobal.com under the News and Views section. And with that, I'll pass it over to Dave. Dave?
All right, thanks, Gassim. Good afternoon to everybody. Thanks for calling in. Always tough after a quarter like this for value. It's frustrating, yet so often it pretends good things for the future. Value had its good 3 or 4 days in the middle of last month. People got excited, but it went back to circling the drain. But hard not to get excited by really what's been left behind, an opportunity to build a really good portfolio. So let's talk about where we stand. In physics, they teach that a body in motion stays in motion. Yet physics will also demonstrate that often gravity can be stronger than momentum. Planets get trapped into orbit. They get trapped into a cyclical pattern. In the markets, same thing. Many liken it to physics. They like to believe that a trend in motion stays in motion. This is understandable in light of the longest and most pronounced period of outperformance by growth and momentum stocks. It's approaching a dozen years. Really unprecedented. And yet, history and logic both show that the markets are not linear. They are cyclical. And this pretends good things. So, where are we in the cycle? Howard Marks likes to point out to a lot of people that you can't predict the future, but you should try to identify where we might be in the cycle. We agree completely. And with that in mind, let's try to examine where we are in the cycle. I thought it might be interesting to include some slides from a presentation I gave a few months ago to the MBAs at USC, comparing the environment that they are entering now with what I entered when I came out of school in the early 80s. Really, they could not be more extreme. So in that world, it was the 15th year of a bear market in equities, 40th year of a bear market in bonds. The U.S. was in recession, a sort of double-dip recession. Inflation was running double digits. There was widespread belief that government deficits couldn't be controlled. People were very worried about a possibility of a couple hundred billion in deficit. There was a solid consensus that inflation was endemic and perpetual, especially in democratic societies. The bearishness was amazing. And yet, here we are, a very different world. We're in a world now where people believe strongly in the ability of the central bankers of the world to prevent bear markets. Since the 81, the Dow Jones is up 93 times this one and reinvested the dividends along the way. We're in the 38th year of the bull market in bonds, about as long as the prior bear market. The longest period ever without a U.S. recession. The measured rate of inflation is persistently negligible. There's widespread belief that deficits don't matter. They shouldn't be controlled. As a matter of fact, they ought to be allowed to run bigger so that we can meet the needs of the population. And there's a belief that deflation is what we should worry about, that inflation is not only not a worry, it cannot be rekindled. The Fed is pushing on a string. So here it is, side by side, a comparison of the two environments then and now, with the backdrop of Warren Buffett's favorite quote, or famous quote, be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy. People were very fearful in 1981. The only thing they're fearful of in 2019 is the fear of missing out. Does price matter? It matters. Compounding is then referred to as the eighth wonder of the world. It's interesting to compare the difference of compounding things at 22%, which is where money market funds were in the early 80s. 10 years of compounding at that rate, $1 million becomes 7.3, sevenfold in your money. Whereas if instead of money markets in 81, one were to put money in a 10-year treasury today, that million, instead of becoming 7 million, you only make $160,000 in profit over a whole decade. Of course, that's good compared to what people in Switzerland face, where investing in their 10-year bond will lose you $100,000 over the life of the 10-year investment. So it was easy making money in 81. It is very hard now, a very challenging time. So here we are in 2019, very tough time to make money in the bond market. Negative yields are something that up until recent years nobody even thought was a possibility. And then, of course, there's the unicorns, which are the equity market's equivalent of negative interest rates. Even they're starting to falter after a lot of exuberant years. Why are people doing this? People want certainty, but in this world there is no certainty. There's only perception of certainty. And once again, Howard Marks says it's all about price. We agree. It's interesting that if people perceive certainty, they run the price to a high level, meaning the perceived low risk actually becomes high risk. And later we'll see that if people do the opposite happens. But anyhow, people love perceived certainty so much that they're willing to take a guaranteed loss, as we mentioned, negative interest rates. And this chart's a little behind. It actually got up to over $17 trillion, trillion with a T, of money that is guaranteed to lose money over the length of the investment period. This is beyond risk. This is guaranteed loss. That's where we stand. Equity valuations, we are now at a period where history shows they might lose money over the next 10 years. Who knows? But logic and history shows that when you pay over 20 times earnings, there is a tendency to make nothing or even lose money over the next decade. And right now, the Shiller PE is in the neighborhood of 30 times. So once again, fairly unprecedented. So bonds are tough, and equities are also a bit challenging. But from here on, the news gets a little better, actually. As they say, it's not a stock market so much as it is a market of stocks. So we do not have to buy the indexes. We don't have to passively buy things at whatever they're priced at. We can choose to buy expensive things, or we can choose to buy very attractively priced things. As this chart shows, other than 1999, never has there been as big a bifurcation, a big gap between the possibility of overpaying versus the possibility of buying things at a bargain. Does valuation matter? Once again, logic and history suggest it matters. So here is some of the times in history where things have gotten on par with current markets in terms of prices paid. They did not end well. So with that in mind, it begs the question, can money be made during the inevitable bust that happens from time to time, and especially happen after these valuations? Our answer is, of course. And as we've been doing, let's keep looking at both logic and history. So, logically, I mentioned the bifurcation. Here's another way of looking at it. If people perceive certainty, they're willing to take a guaranteed loss in Switzerland, a guaranteed loss in Japan and most of Europe. And in the U.S., you can actually get positive rates, although not much of positive rates. Remember what the central bank said when they started all this. They said their goal was to make bonds so unattractive as to force money into and do other asset classes, which they believed would make people feel wealthy and they would spend money that would be good for the economy. Whether it's helped the economies of the world is highly debatable. Whether they succeeded in making other asset classes become expensive, I don't think anybody would argue against that. They've done a phenomenal job. So they have done so well now that lots of investment grade bonds now in the world have negative interest rates. The former pigs, as they used to call them, Portugal and Italy and Greece and Spain, all have negative interest rates. Some out the curve a little bit. Greece just placed a 10-year bond at rates that are less than the U.S. rates. Really, stuff that was unimaginable 5 or 6 years ago. As you go a little further away from guarantees, but to where you're probably going to get somewhat the cash you expect, quality franchises are good businesses with good cash flows that everybody should like. It's just that they are so bond-like that they've been sent up to unprecedented levels, levels such we saw in 72, the last time they took quality franchises to these kind of very aggressive levels. So I show you the other chart. When you pay above 20 times earnings, and usually it's good companies when people pay those kind of things, if it doesn't work out, high yield bonds, I guess I've been spoiled in my career buying pretty good companies yielding in the teens to buy really much lower quality high yield bonds than we used to see in the past and get mid single digits is not attractive. But as you move a little further away, when you get to global stocks, people are usually willing to give you a better deal on global stocks than they are U.S. stocks, and now it starts to get a little interesting. And then, if they like certainty too much, they seem to hate uncertainty a little too much. They hate volatility. So, logic and history have shown that emerging markets grow faster than ones that have already emerged, and that more money is made investing in emerging markets over long periods of time, but they're more volatile. Therefore, you can actually buy them at way cheaper prices, and if risk, as we believe, is the prospect of permanent loss of capital, they become less risky if they become cheaper. So, interesting enough, low-vol stocks have become quite risky, and high-vol stocks have actually become very low-risk. Interesting. And then, as you've heard for us a lot over recent times, and it's starting to work in a few asset classes, but not yet in energy, is scarce assets have value. And if you can buy scarce assets at half of what it would take to replace them, you're likely to double your money. You just don't know when. So the one end of the curve, likely to double your money. At the other end of the curve, guaranteed to lose your money. Each person can make their own choice about how they want to deal with that. You know where we stand. Going from logic to history, the history of what worked when the markets fell at that 16-year bear market in the 70s. One thing that worked, probably won't surprise anybody, is gold. So this is a period where stocks fell in half over a long period of time, and adjusted for inflation, they fell 80-90%. And over this period of time, gold went from $35 to briefly $800. It was an outstanding investment. Gold miners did even better. People can say, oh, but that was an inflationary period. This isn't inflationary now. So at the bottom, we've included the deflationary depression of the 1930s. Market down 73%, more from top to bottom. And yet gold miners were up roughly five times over that time period. So inflationary bust, deflationary bust, gold did quite well. So people are saying, fine, you have people who may or may not like gold. So let's move on. Let's move on to oil. Yeah. Oil went pretty much nowhere for a half century. People had sort of given up on it. And then in the 1970s, like stocks were falling, oil made that move. This is adjusted for inflation, non-adjusted inflation. They went up more than 10 times from 3-something to $36. Pretty good place to be. As a matter of fact, oil went from not much lights at the beginning of the decade to, I was just looking, 8 of the 10 largest market caps on Earth were oil companies following this run. So they went from unloved to overly loved. But oil was a good place to be during the last set of challenging times. Oil and oil service. This is Schlumberger, which was one of those top 5. As a matter of fact, it became number 1 in the late 70s, although I haven't been able to substantiate that. But gold was a good place to be. Oil was a good place to be. Oil service was a good place to be. For those of you who are saying enough with the resources, let's move on. Japan was a good place to be. We've talked about this in the past. We've talked about how John Templeton, he made a lot of money when other people were losing money in the U.S. and Europe. He bought Japan when Japan was more of a growing market. You had growth, you had really, really low fees, real bargain prices. But nobody was much interested in Japan right then. With hindsight, it was obvious. But at the time, people viewed Japan pretty much the way people view Russia now. They say, well, who cares if the PEs are 3? This is our enemy. This is the person we fought in the war a few decades ago. This is a country that has corruption, that has mafia, that has political skirmishes, and big businesses that we don't trust. Yet, if risk is about valuation and opportunity is about valuation, Japan proved to be a very good place to be. We suggest that some of the emerging markets now that are underappreciated are likely to be the place to be. We can go on with other things. There are things that work, but also it's worth pointing out, we're 100% bottom-up, and as being 100% bottom-up, we're used to generally going into a headwind all the time. So every now and then, you get a tailwind, and here we are now. Remember 10 years ago when it became clear that the central banks of the world were going to print a lot of money, people ran gold to the moon, they ran oil to the moon, they ran emerging markets, they ran agriculture, they ran infrastructure funds, they ran emerging markets. It was, people said, we got to own these things because the central banks are going to print money. They ran them to high prices, and they've been falling ever since for the most part. The Austrian economist told us, and what many of us instinctively knew, central banks aren't capable of taking away the ease, just taking away the punch bowl for very long. So they tried to tighten for a few years. It failed miserably. We saw last December that the credit markets broke down. Equity markets were starting to fall. Europeans and Japanese quickly made sure that we knew they were ready to print whatever it takes. The Fed said, all right, we're going to stop tightening too, and very quickly thereafter, the Secretary of the Treasury said, we have called the plunge protection team to start monetizing the market. They made it clear they were ready to start reprinting money. And this chart shows they've started. As most of you realize, a month ago or so, the repo market broke down. The government had to step in and bail it out. They started printing money. And more recently, they announced QE4 of the tune of $60 billion a month. They've made clear that they don't want us to call it QE4. But they are printing money to buy treasuries. It's QE. And so, remember last time they did this, they ran all those stocks, like I mentioned, gold, oil, energy markets, they ran them to the moon. Now they are printing, and we can buy all these things for a song. So get value and a tailwind at the same time. That's pretty interesting. As far as the valuations we've seen, let's go back to John Templeton again. You know, back when he was buying Japan, when he was buying other stuff, he was saying, well, if you can buy stocks at 2x earnings, you'll lose on half of them, but you'll end up making money. The ones that make money will make a lot of money. And so, therefore, the whole portfolio will do very well. And, of course, he had a tremendous track record. In the zero-interest rate world, you will not find things at 2x earnings. You will find things that are a third of intrinsic value, a third of what it would take to replace those things, a third of what it would take to have equilibrium over a long term. Likely, then, you're going to triple your money on some of these things. Some of them you'll lose on. Some will turn out to be value traps. But most of them will work, and most of them will pay some pretty meaningful returns. So this is really, within an overvalued market, a devalued market for the things that people don't like. So it's time to buy intrinsic value and then be patient and wait for it to work. As we've repeatedly pointed out to people, patience is worth it. If a person buys a 10-year bond, we said they can expect to make 1.5% a year. If they make something that's going to double in 10 years, instead of 1.5% a year, they make 7.2% a year. And by the way, maybe it doubles in 7 years and you make 10%. Maybe it doubles in 4 years and you make almost 20% a year. Maybe it doubles in 2 years, you're making 41% a year. So under most any conceivable environment, this is way, way, way preferable to buying bonds or bond-like surrogates in the form of quality franchises and grade A real estate and that sort of thing. And so there are so many of these great opportunities that we've been able to put together portfolios that are 70% of tangible book, not that much over half of book value, not much over 1x sales, 4x gross cash flow, phenomenal sort of valuations. This is better than 99 in terms of the ability to buy very, very cheap stocks in the midst of what otherwise could be considered a mania. And so that's where we are. What we've been able to do recently is just buy some very cheap companies in Japan. We've been able to add the things that used to be loved, like telecom and agriculture. We've been able to take profits and things. I remember, was it 4 or 5 years ago, Electrobras was our worst stock. Since then, it's done so well that it's our best stock for the last 7 years. It's up 10x off the bottom, so we've trimmed that pretty aggressively. We had to be patient for a long time on Gazprom. Went nowhere, but it was paying a nice dividend while we waited, and this year it's almost doubled. Some of the gold stocks, not telling the last 3 or 4 weeks, have had a tremendous move, so as you would expect, we've taken some profits there. The weight on some of the transportation companies is starting to pay off, so we've been able to take stuff there, and like I say, move it more into emerging markets, more into quality franchises, that sort of thing. And so we're happy to own some of the dominant phone companies in places like China and places like Korea. And when you add it all up, we continue to have a portfolio geared to the growing parts of the world and underweighted in the mature parts of the world. We tend to own the number one and two players in the world, the top two uranium producers and some of the biggest phone companies in the world and the two biggest trading companies in the world and the two biggest hydroelectric generation companies in the world and so on and so forth. So we love bifurcated markets. Bifurcated markets usually happen when too few people are doing active management, and that sows the seeds for active management to do well. So with active managers and especially value managers having struggled, people can each make up their own mind on where we might be in the cycle. But we think the last 12 years is actually ending up right about where we have been now. This is looking like a great time for people to move a little bit from the growth to value. And we're happy to be where we are right now. And appreciate everybody's interest and happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, if you do have a question, please send us by pressing star 1. Again, that will be star 1 for questions. We'll hear first today from Dan Gallagher with UBS.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for these calls. Wondering if you could just, you know, it seems like GE's popping back in, and just wondering how you can get your mind around some of these liability issues. Is it just, you know, a sense of a super strong management and, you know, I'm just wondering how you could get conviction there. And then secondly, perhaps you could talk about some of the new additions in the portfolio.
Certainly. Yeah, now GE is an interesting and a beautiful case in point of how we do things. You know, whether it's the price of a commodity or the price of a company or certainty around liabilities or regulation or those things, we tend to try to be as educated as we can be, but never try to believe we know the future. And then we wait for the crowd, the millions of people out there and the investment public that often get things right to lose what we think is any sensible view of things. So you say, for example, in 1989, people had such an outrageously high opinion of Japan's ability to whoop us all economically that everything was priced at really high prices, so we owned none of them. 7 years ago, we had 25% of the portfolio in Japan before the market took off when Abe won, because you could buy things at a third of book value. You could buy them at less than cash. Both of those were extremes. You know, when Obama became president, people were so sure it was the end of healthcare that we went from owning no healthcare there to big positions in Pfizer and Lilly and Amgen and Aetna and so on. You wait for what we all saw. You know, people can dislike Russia or Putin, but 4 years ago they hated Russia with such a passion that we were able to buy things at 5 cents on the dollar, and then it's probably been the best performing market in the world since then. You wait for these extremes. So GE, one extreme was, 17, 18 years ago, when it was the largest market cap on the entire planet by, I think, three times as big as the next biggest one. Everybody loved it. Jack Welch was worshipped. People were paying really high prices for this thing. And that was despite the fact that this was a company that, as Jim Grant put it at the time, it was known to have manipulated earnings. They were proud of hitting these earnings on the spot every quarter. Well, that doesn't happen in real life. You knew they were manipulated. You would look at the stuff they were buying and selling, and the prices didn't necessarily make so much sense. And you would look at their booming credit book over the years and think, well, this is not a good time to have a booming credit book. And so, you know, 38 years in the business, till last December, I never owned GE at any point in my career. By last December, it was the exact opposite. Yeah, people went from worshiping it to, it was almost unanimous that these guys are going to go bankrupt. Now, in a world where most debt nowadays is at the bottom, the very bottom of investment grade or below in junk, and here is this investment grade rated company that everybody thought was going to go bankrupt tomorrow. We don't know for sure, but it's highly unlikely. And instead of having grown their credit book a lot, they had shrunk it a lot. And after years of mismanagement, they have been doing a few more things right. And early on, and they brought in Polk, who has a really great record in his past. So people gave them no credit for that. We went in business by business. We spent almost a year analyzing this thing before we bought it. And we did business by business, and we didn't trust their accounting at all. We compared their margins to their competitors' margins, which were way, way lower, and we assigned those margins to them. And
sure,
then it's
just,
yeah.
Sure, so what's the management as usual? Linda, that was here earlier.
Oh,
I guess somebody. But anyhow, so it's interesting how nobody worries about potential problems in a portfolio until after the problems have been written off. And so once they acknowledge that they had plenty of problems in the book, now the news is out there, but the stock was down. And so we went there and said, all right, well, if a few things go right, the stock's worth 18, and if a lot of things go wrong, it's probably worth 6, and when you add it all up, we're certainly comfortable paying 12, but we don't buy things at that, so we waited till it fell to 9, and we bought, and then it went to 8 and 7 and 6 something, we bought a lot more, and then when it bounced to close to 12, we sold a lot of it. Then, for some reason, a couple of months ago, it fell back into the sevens again. We bought what we could, but it didn't stay down long enough. We only got a little bit. We tried to buy a lot more. But now here it is, back well above 9, we're doing okay with it. Yeah, so to us, we're buying far and away the best jet engine manufacturer in the world. We're buying one of the best 2 healthcare people in the world, one of the top 2 or 3 power generation businesses in the world. We're buying one of the top couple oil service companies in the world. And so, and we give them no credit for the finance part of it. We just, let's just assume it's worthless. And then, as we always do, we took a big risk adjustment to the whole thing. So, did we have certainty? No. Have we looked at all kinds of potential outcomes, and the vast majority lead to us making a lot of profit, and only extreme unforeseens would lead to losing the money. So we love the risk-reward on that thing, and it's worked well. It's where the trimming and adding on prices really helps. New positions in Japan over the summer was getting cheap. It's bounced somewhat since then. Back in the 30s, Graham and Dodd used to talk about buying things at less than cash, pretty much. You generally don't see that nowadays, but we were able to do a little bit of it in Japan 5 years ago, and then we were able to do a little bit of it with things like Fukuda over the summer. And so that's a small name, but it'd be bought it for essentially free, the way we do analysis. And then there's Intex, which is an oil company that, between people not liking Japan and people not liking oil, it got very cheap. That's done okay. The rest are not new positions, but we find it interesting that, a mere 19 years ago, people would pay damn near infinity for a phone company. And now we get to buy the top 2 phone companies in China and the number 2 phone company in Korea for single-digit PEs, for discounts to book value and growing markets. We've been able to, as we try to do, buy utilities for way less than both book and adjusted book based on age adjusting and replacing the infrastructure they have. Yeah, Mitsui's one that we've been able to buy and sell over the years. And the transportation, we've always liked the fact that You would think they would trade together. You would think oil tankers and dry bulk tankers and specialty tankers and cargo containers would all trade together. But you know, you guys have seen over the last 5 or 6 years, we were able to buy oil. It ran up. We sold that and bought dry bulk. And then dry bulk ran up and we were able to go back into oil. Now oil tanker stock has run up and we've reduced by adding to salt meals in, which is a specialty chemical tanker. So wonderful inefficiencies in the market there. And so nothing major, just taking advantage of the volatility over the summer.
And are you still rolling out of the money puts?
We are. Like everything we do, just like the tankers I mentioned where they lose money every month until they shoot up to their intrinsic value. A put option, as most of you know, is something that gains value as a market drops or the underlying asset drops. Who knows if and when the market will drop. What we do know is that the longer it goes without dropping, more likely it's going to drop. The more expensive it gets relative to where it's been in history, the more likely it's going to drop. Here it is on most multiples, the most expensive in the history of the country. The value of the put option is clearly higher now than at most any other time in history. And yet, the valuation of the put option is not the most expensive in history. It's not even average. It has been bouncing around over the last 3 years at levels that are the lowest in history. They've been around 12 implied vol, plus or minus 4, so sort of 8 to 16. Phenomenal. So this means that a 1% position could make 15, 20, 25 times if there's a correction in the market. Now, 3 years ago, things have gone a long, long time without correcting, and now they've gone 3 more years without correcting. It's sort of like the Big Short, where those guys had to endure about 3 years of mortgages not falling and various clients not being happy about it until finally the inevitable happened. It's inevitable the market will correct. When and from where is not known. So one or two things will happen. The market will fall and these will pay off nicely for us, or the market will start pricing these things much more expensive, and as value guys, we will stop buying them and move on to the next thing. But interesting how over the years, things like oil moved instantly for us, and uranium didn't move instantly, and gold took a while and moved strongly. The tankers went better. We'll see if and when the market gets around to having an inevitable correction. But very, very attractively priced.
Thank you, Dave.
And again, for questions, that is star one at this time. We'll hear next from Chris Hutchuli with Merrill Lynch.
Hey Dave, just a question on your model portfolio characteristics. I noticed that looks like one of the largest holdings in international is Turquoise Hill Resources. And, when I was looking at your past month's holdings, I didn't see that in your top 10. Just wondering if that's correct information. And also, if you did increase it, why?
Yeah, and the stock is one of the things we very much like. We like when the market overreacts. And in our opinion, there's various ways to appraise businesses, but when you're looking at natural resources that are going to be extracting oil, gold, copper, you name it, for the next 30 years, whatever that incentive price is over the next 30 years is what you're likely to make, plus or minus. And what last quarter's earnings were really doesn't matter too much. So sometimes they overreact on earnings. This was a little more serious than earnings. This is a business that is very, very difficult business, and often costs turn out to be higher than you expect them to be, and they've come out and said this costs might be $1.5 billion more than we thought they were. So we subtracted that from our model that we thought it was worth. That reduced our estimate by less than 8%. The market went down 80%. So that's a huge reaction. And as it was falling, we were buying. Now, we never put more than 5% in one name. And then resources have been lots of small cap names that we've been able to buy across the board, and we held it. And that one is just falling. We sold some of the winners and went into that one. We thought earlier than we could have, I guess, because it's gone down. It fell a lot before we bought it, but it's fallen a lot since then. We do not put more than 5% of our money into any one name. So if you reach a maximum position and it falls in half to 2.5%, we leave it at 2.5%. And so that's where we are with that name. Our disciplines keep us from buying more of that one, so we're buying more of other stocks instead, some of the other ones that have fallen. In international, we waited later to build the position as big, so we're fortunate we're able to hold a little more there. But both of them have 20 to 25% and very, very attractively priced resource companies.
Thank you.
We'll hear next from Bradley Calder with the Investment Fund for Foundations.
Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Question for you on your gold investments. One of the bigger long-term risks for your thesis is substitution on the margin by savers away from gold and towards another non-sovereign store of value asset that's harder than gold. As you probably know, Bitcoin stock-to-flow ratio will be quite close to that of gold when Bitcoin mining rewards are halved in May of 2020. Have you considered adding a small Bitcoin investment to your portfolio to hedge the risk of substitution away from gold? Thanks.
Sure. Well, there's two things there. Should people put 1% of their portfolio in Bitcoin or something like that? We have no problem with people doing that. I know a lot of very smart people that seem to like Bitcoin. It actually seems like an interesting speculation. Like you say, the potential is huge. To us, though, it is a speculation. If you take three categories, if you take cryptocurrency, and you take gold, and you take fiat currencies, do we worry about people abandoning gold to go into cryptocurrencies? Not too much. Nobody owns gold. Everybody owns fiat currencies. People have many trillions of dollars of fiat currencies, and your average person has less than 1% of their money in gold. So I would suspect over the next 10 years you will see massive rotation out of fiat currencies into gold and possibly Bitcoin. The advantages to Bitcoin, you point out some of it. The stock to flow, the potential is really big. However, if you're comparing something that has proven to be money for thousands of years that can't be chemically reproduced, that you don't, it's nobody's liability, you don't have to trust anybody. Fiat currencies would be great if we could trust the governments not to print more, but they always do. And Bitcoin, they've got this great formula. They're going to come up with less and less, so it's scarce. And so we don't have to worry about it. except for who do we trust being? You know, can we trust this formula? Can we trust that there won't be blackouts, power outages, sunspot things, manipulation of the program, other coins coming out and getting popular? I'm not saying any of this stuff will happen. I'm just saying you can have absolute, complete confidence that gold, with all its negatives in there plenty, is a good store of value. Always has been and probably always will be. You don't have to trust anybody. Bitcoin, if it's trustworthy, I agree. It'll be pretty good. So the answer to your question, maybe people should speculate in it. There's tremendous upside. But to store people's wealth, you certainly don't want to store it in currencies that have negative yields with central banks that are promising to make it lose value. I would view fiat currencies to slowly rotate into gold, platinum, silver, and possibly Bitcoin. And if they do, the upside is huge.
Thanks, Dave.
And we have a follow-up from Dan Gallagher.
Yeah, Dave, in terms of, some of us, viewed commodities as like fixed income returns with equity volatility and have ignored this thing, almost thankfully, I guess, for a long time, but open-minded to this. If you were, helping wealthy families kind of put this kind of a hedge in there, for it to matter, it seemed like it'd have to be somewhere between 5 and 10% of a portfolio. I would think that you would be able to put less there if you did mining companies, or the equities, or maybe a levered bet on instead of the individual commodity. But to get gold, do you have to buy gold? Or, is there counterparty risk issues in owning, an ETF of gold? How might, if you were to spread, some type of commodity exposure, 10%, how might you spread a dollar out for a high net worth family?
Yeah. Very good question. It's an interesting market for value investors. The world's a little tough, but really not that tough. All we have to have is patience, because when you buy things too cheap, you make money. It's a matter of when. You guys all have a way tougher job than we do, because you have to meet the needs of people that need cash flow in a world where there is no cash flow. And you need to ascertain people's ability to stay patient. And so, that stuff, hats off to you guys. But as to what people ought to think about this, there are two things. Yes, I believe that things have become so cheap in the resources that a lot of our clients believe that putting 4 or 5% of their money in something like this actually decreases the risk of the entire portfolio, because this in 2016 and in 2008, 2009 and 2003, they did very well when other things weren't doing well. Yeah, unfortunately, they tend to lag when momentum is doing very well. But it often is counter-cyclical, or it especially works well, or even less December and whatnot. And so there is a feeling that adding something like this to a portfolio is protection, decreases the risk of the whole portfolio, protects the downside. Now, if somebody puts something like this in there, yes, somebody can buy gold, or they can buy gold ETFs, or they can go with gold miners, or they can go with gold mutual funds. The answer is not easy, but like everything, it comes down to what is my price, what upside does that give me relative to the risk it gives me. Just as normally people can say, I have cash, should I buy a stock with it? You should only buy the stock with the cash if the stock is so cheap that you're likely to end up with a lot more cash when it's all said and done. I think people should own gold and not part with their gold unless the gold stocks become so cheap that you're likely to end up with way more gold than you start out with, adjusted for the risk. Gold is better than gold stocks. However, gold stocks, over the last 10 years, gold's gone up and gold stocks have gone up 65%. So now gold stocks are so much cheaper than gold. The upside is tremendous under most any scenario you can think of. So we would recommend that people buy a diversified portfolio of gold stocks that aren't looking for gold, the ones that have found it, that own a bunch in the ground, and that you'll end up buying gold at a huge, huge discount to the $1,500. But if somebody wants to hold gold, to your question, you can hold physical gold. You can find a place to store it. You have to pay for that. Or you can buy an ETF. And ETFs way easier, way more liquid, better in a lot of ways, with the exception of there are people who don't trust that they have the gold. There are people that, well, the numbers even show way more gold gets traded than exists. And we know there's gold futures out there. And GLD, they refuse to allow auditors to come in there and verify it. And so I don't take one side or the other on whether the gold is there, but I, for one, would prefer owning physical gold and paying the minimal storage costs than going with a GLD. However, there are people now, various people, that will hold the physical gold for you. It's yours, it's with ID. There's also Sprott up in Canada, and full disclosure, we own their stock. But they will audit and own the physical gold instead of the paper gold. So Sprott or some of the people that hold the physical gold are preferable, we think, to the GLD. And the good miners at these prices are preferable to that. That's our take.
We'll move on to Patricia Speller with Merrill Lynch.
Hey, Dave. Always glad to hear your insights. They're a lot of fun. I wonder if today you might drill down and share your thoughts and help us understand what the heck this whole liquidity thing is about that we keep reading about. And I think you sort of alluded to it earlier maybe with the repos. But what's your take on what's going on with all that?
Oh, I mean, I might defer from that. You've read it, I read it, we've all read it. We know something's going on. We can assume it's serious since they felt like they had to come to the rescue. But the actual mechanics and what's happening and why, I'm probably not your best source.
So you're not any clearer than the rest of us are, huh? Or you feel it's a valid, better part of valor is not to go there.
Well, we're not going to go there, but we do find it interesting that why there are so many things that are uncertain like that. It's the higher the level of uncertainty out there, you would expect higher interest rates, not lower interest rates, and lower stock prices, not higher. And so, we find it interesting that the market doesn't care that nobody knows what's going on.
Me too. Well, at least I feel company in the dark. Thank you.
Sure.
We'll hear next from Anthony Eichler with Stonebridge Capital.
Hey, Dick. A couple quick comments on just briefly Northern Dynasty and Range Resources. Any update on those?
Sure. Very different company. Northern Dynasty, one of the biggest known gold deposits and copper deposits in the world. And they had a million obstacles to building the mine under the Obama administration. Most of those obstacles have pretty much gone away now. And so now it's a whole lot of gold and copper in the United States of America trading for a song. But this is a world that's not patient, and you will not see any gold mines in the next 5 years. And so people don't like that. We love the optionality. It's going to be a long time for that to play out, but the upside is humongous. Range Resources, almost the opposite of that. Range Resources is such that has a bunch of gas. They have great properties they're producing. They're making earnings. They're making cash flow. They're doing fairly well. The stock dropped from 90 to 12, and we buy it. And then we're from 12 to 4. And we don't know why. Insiders are buying. And this was once the darling of the world, and it's making money. And if the price of gas can merely go to $3.50, we see tremendous upside on this. If it goes below $2, we see downside. But very good property. But Northern Dynasty is the one with massive optionality.
Thanks so much.
And we'll take a follow-up from Gary Magnuson.
Yes, I was just wondering, have you looked at any of the, or what is the effect of the banks in Europe that are experiencing negative rates? And then also, have you looked at any of the auto companies like Daimler or BMW in terms of any thoughts in that industry?
Yeah, we put a lot of time into Volkswagen, Porsche, and we've... we're looking at Toyota, we own Hyundai. It's an industry where we insist upon really cheap prices because there's not huge barriers to entry. I'm sure there's a lot of capital. Let's just look how many people are in the business. Lots of people in the business. They're being sold on 7-year loans, and you know, it's not our first choice, but they've become so cheap that, yes, we own one, and we... might own more. And then the first part of the question was?
Oh, banks and then negative interest rates.
Oh, yeah, banks. Yeah. Now, banks are something that are an important part of the economy, and we're always interested, but because they're levered 10 to 1 plus or minus, and because there's so many difficulties in the world, we usually insist upon huge discounts. And for that reason, we haven't owned a lot, but in the early 90s, we owned U.S. financials, and after the 09-10, we bought a bunch of emerging markets, strong banks in Thailand and India and Russia and places like that. And 7 years ago, we were able to buy a couple financials in Japan for 38% of book value. That worked out very well. And we've done well the last 6 or 7 years with Sberbank. To your point, banks have been beaten up for a long time. So we are looking at banks in Europe. We're looking at banks in Asia. Looking at banks in emerging markets. And it's interesting what to make of negative interest rates. Yeah. On the one hand, people are maybe too down on it because borrowing at 1% and loaning it out at 2%, maybe that's no different than borrowing at minus 100 basis points and loaning out for free. You're still making a 100% spread. So maybe that's okay, although maybe 100 basis points disintermediates the banks and people just stop using them. I don't know. It's interesting, but it's amazing that it was a mere, 11, 12 years ago that banks were 45% of the value index and a third of all country world, and now they're hated. So, we're spending plenty of time looking at them. It's an interesting area.
Thank you.
And at this time, I'd like to turn things back to Dave for closing remarks.
All right. Well, good questions, and thanks, everybody, for dialing in, and look forward to talking to you again in 3 months. Thank you.
That will conclude today's conference. Again, thank you all for joining us.